everyone. This is Joanne Beaudry-Larocque, and this time I thought for today I would read one of my other published works, which was published in the magazine High Grader magazine in 2009. It was the article, because it was kind of on the longer side, was put into three different dates for the magazine. So first one would be late summer 2009, then autumn 2009, and Christmas 2009. And I wanted to write about being a child of an Ontario Hydro family. My father worked for Ontario Hydro, and a lot of the time, to better their employment, to better their experience and work experience, they would move to different hydro generating stations or dams or that kind of different dams and transformer stations and generating stations. So he worked as an operator, and an operator back when my father was working for Ontario Hydro would be, it's more computerized now, but back then it would be, the job would be quite intense, because it was to regulate the flow of water that generated electricity, and it would be, his job also was to regulate the flow of electricity so that all areas that wherever he was stationed at would be covered for power. And so this was his job. And we moved to different locations, sort of like a military family would move every 4 or 5 years or so to a different military base. And a lot of the times growing up in the Hydro family, we would do the same. So I figured I would write about this, and I entitled it, I Have No Hometown. And as I read this story, memoir to you, you'll see why I wrote that, I Have No Hometown. And I meant it as part of my growing up years. I live now in Greater Sudbury, Ontario, which is considered kind of Northern Ontario. And so I do have a hometown now, but growing up, I kind of reflected back on all the places that I grew up in. They're no longer in existence. And so as I read this story to you, you'll see why I entitled this article, I Have No Hometown. I think I wrote it in 2006, and it was published in 2009. So here goes. I Have No Hometown by Joanne K. Beaudry-Larocque, Northern Ontario and its ghostly remnants of the past. My father was an operator with Ontario Hydro. With my parents and my five younger brothers, we resided in small Northern Ontario remote communities where Ontario Hydro operation stations were located. The reason I titled this article, I Have No Hometown, is that as an adult in my 50s, I'm not able to actively visit five of my childhood hometowns or point out the houses or schools that I attended because they no longer exist. Which makes me wonder, is Northern Ontario slowly dying? Because with the closure of lumber mills, small factories, and currently computer-generated operating stations, it is no wonder that more and more small Northern Ontario communities are becoming just a memory. As a young girl from 1956 to 1973, my family resided in small hydro communities, or colonies. In September 1956, my parents lived in Goward with my grandparents, and then in November 1956, we moved to two separate apartments in Cobalt. These were apartments were in people's homes. My father worked three shifts, and after the 3 weeks of 7 days, 7 afternoons, and 7 midnights, we visited my grandparents. They lived near Tomogamy. In May of 1958, in the Upper Notch out of Cobalt, we moved to and lived there for 8 months. The houses were above the generating station on a hill, and there were a total of 8 families that resided there. The few children that lived there would have to be transported by a school bus to Cobalt, for the community was not big enough to have its own school. Although there was a little community hall which hosted many of the children's parties, i.e. Halloween and Christmas, and yearly parties where adults would also have seasonal dances and get-togethers. Ping pong tournaments were extremely popular, especially between my dad and a few other people in this tiny community. Many years later, Hydro pulled out those 8 homes and the area was flooded out and it is no longer in existence. Within a year, my father was transferred to another generating station in Matabituan, which is out of North Cobalt in February 1959 to 1963. He worked at the Matabituan River Electrical Power Generating Station. There were a total of 5 families and a few men, which were also Hydro operators who lived in the Hydro-owned staff house. All the families were involved with the Hydro station, whom all lived in a row housing unit with adjoining basements. I remember my father and his friend built a playground for us Hydro kids, which consisted of an old pipe swing set and a rickety wooden spinning wheel that we would have to push by running beside it to get that thing going. We kids were worn out daily by trying to make that wheel spin faster and faster. We used to love playing in the covered sandbox, but the black flies were so bad that my mother would cut her nylon stockings to make fly nets. The nets were made from the top of her nylon stockings, and a knot was then made at the cut edge that the opened end was slid over our heads. We were ready for the bush and the flies. My mom filled the time with baking casseroles and muffins from scratch. She would also make and sew our clothes, using old newspapers as an outline for my dresses and pants and shirts for my brothers. She would then hang out the laundry on the clothesline from reaching out of an upstairs window to hang the clothes and would take a few minutes to share a cup of coffee with a few lady friends that resided in this small, remote location. Besides the quietness, there were the odd bears, cougars, and wolves. So as kids, we would always have to be aware of our surroundings when playing outside. On Tuesday nights during the winters, we spent with weekly visits to each other's homes to play a fun game of cribbage. That would be the parents. Also, during the winter months, the adults would get together to curl on the natural ice in a small one-sheet curling rink. On weekends, there would be bonspiels between other teams that would come in from out of town. The roads weren't plowed regularly, and sometimes my parents would have to drive through treacherous conditions such as a foot of snow. Some hills on the road were very steep, and when the 1956 Dodge automobile couldn't make the snowy hills on the road, we would have to drive backwards down the hill and then jack up the car to proceed to put chains around the tires. In one instance, while going up one hill, the car stalled and the ignition broke down. My dad backed down to the side of the road and took the toboggan out of the truck, which we carried with us whenever we would go into town, and loaded us kids on the toboggan. He had to pull us on the toboggan for 3 miles at 11 p.m. in the evening in December. The final steep hill before approaching the colony, my dad went on the toboggan with my brothers and me and slid down the rest of the way. My mother, who was pregnant with her 4th child, walked gingerly the rest of the way down the hill. Fridays was the weekly grocery, doctor, and appointment days. It would take an hour of driving to get to North Cobalt, and then on to New Lisker to do all the errands and appointments, and then head back. But in the spring, the dirt road from North Cobalt tended to wash out, so we would all pile out of the car and walk into our residents. Unfortunately, Ontario Hydro subsequently, many years ago, took out the row houses, and this tiny colony now no longer exists. There was no school in Matabituan, and being the oldest child of six kids, and only daughter, by the way, at the young age of 6 years old, I had to move in with my grandparents. This was from September 1962 to May 1963 to attend school in Goward, near Temagami, Ontario. I started grade one in a dark but warm one-room schoolhouse with old wooden creaky floors and one elderly lady teacher. There were a total of about 20 children, where we all sat together in neat rows in our wooden ink-stained student desks in the schoolhouse. There was only another girl named Susan in grade one, but the teacher also taught the rest of the kids in their appropriate classes, which went up to grade eight. It was a happy, close-knit school with a lively and friendly teacher who I enjoyed. In the winter months, it was kept warm with an old wood stove in the back of the building. During our recess, we would use an old bowling set, and everyone would take their turns to knock down the pins at the back of the classroom. I remember every morning as I set off for school, which was across the railroad tracks from my grandparents' green wooden house in Goward, I would always look back and my grandmother would be watching me to see if I made it safely to school. I remember waving to her and she always waved back. My grandfather, whom we call Pappy, who worked at the Temagami Timber Sawmill, working 10-hour days sorting pickets. These particular pickets were an inch square and 12 to 36 inches long, and also piling pickets in the lumber yard to put the pickets in a boxcar, which was shipped to a factory. My grandmother, who we called Nanny, owned a small ice cream store out of her veranda, which she operated during the summer. To keep the ice cream cold, she would use the blocks of ice taken from Net Lake during the winter months that my grandfather would keep in the Stottis shed. I remember my grandfather carrying a large wooden gray yoke around his neck with two stainless steel silver pails filled with water from the local well, or at times water from the lake. It was called Net Lake. Together, both of my grandparents would also take care of the general store, with my grandfather working as the postmaster at the tiny post office and my grandmother running the general store. I used to spend many hours in the general store just trying on the hats and writing in my books to pass the time. I still remember the smells of that general store. I also would help my grandparents set the place settings on the long dining room tables at the bunkhouses for the men of the lumber yards, where they would gather to dine for the evening meal. I can recall my grandparents telling me that during the Great Depression, the unemployed men that used to travel on the trains would stop or jump off in Goward. These desperate men would just show up in front of my grandparents' wooden screen door because they heard that they could get a free sandwich from the kind family, my grandparents, the Millettes. Sometimes my grandmother was a bit nervous when there was a stranger and a very hungry man standing at the door asking for something to eat, but that didn't stop her from making them a sandwich. She would also give what she could. If there was a vegetable or beef stew in a pot on their shiny green and ivory-colored wood stove that dominated the kitchen with its shiny silver stove pipe and a pile of lumber beside it, she would willingly give them a bowl. My grandparents always felt sorry for all the poor men that had no work or no money. Another event that occurred while living at my grandparents', one of the houses right next door to them was struck by lightning, which I can recall standing on the porch and watching the neighbor's house burn to the ground. The young family got out in time, but sadly not the dog. The fire truck from Temagami didn't get there in time to save the house. To this day, I keep all my negatives of pictures, important papers, and now computer CDs or external hard drives with digital photos in a safety deposit box, just in case. And I will always have that feeling of how all you have can be destroyed in minutes, which has never left me. On a recent trip to that old section of what was the Goward that I remember, I picked up some reddish-colored rocks on the shoreline of Net Lake, as I felt that maybe my grandfather walked on these rocks while going to fetch us some drinking water using those shiny silver pails. That old part of Goward is no longer in existence. The school is gone, the general store, the post office, bunkhouses, my grandmother's little veranda store, all gone. All of the houses that I can remember, which were my grandparents' neighbors, have all vanished. Part 2. I have no hometown. In the summer of 1963 to 1965, my parents moved to Hunta, which is a small farming community near Cochrane. There was two or three houses which belonged to the Hydro families, ours included. And the rest of the scattered homes belonged to the families that generally ran small farms. Ontario Hydro had a small generating station there, and my father would literally walk across our yard to work. To attend school, I was able to be with my brothers, where we would board a bus daily to attend the Cochrane Public School. I passed my grade 2 to grade 4 in the Cochrane School, and on weekends I would bring home a girlfriend or two to spend time with, as it was not always fun to hang out with my younger brothers all the time. Again, my father built us a swing set. In the winter, we would have Super 8 films playing and skated on the outdoor skating rink. My father would religiously water the rink so that we could have a smooth surface to skate on. I remember riding my two-wheeler for the first time in the summer, and no matter how hard or fast I would go, my father would still outrun my bike. It was in Hunta where we first saw a rabbit fox down by the stream and watched in amazement as the poor animal was foaming from the mouth. We could hear the loud local cows mooing and for fun and games try not to jump into the cow patties. As I recall once when my mother opened the back door, she jumped in horror as my younger brother thought it would be funny to scare her as they held up a wooden branch with a dead snake hanging loosely in the air. She was not too pleased indeed. In Hunta, we also would watch the Ed Sullivan Show on Sunday nights in black and white, where John, Paul, Ringo, and George appeared on the television show as the new band called The Beatles. We all watched the boob tube in amazement, although my parents were shocked at their hairstyles. I remember my dad looking towards my brothers sporting their brush cuts and warned them that no son of mine is ever going to have long hair like that, like those boys on TV. Even though my father spent a lot of time with some of the locals playing endless games of billiards in the garage next door, he did bring us to the show in Cochrane, which the very first movie I ever saw was Mary Poppins. I was hooked on movies ever since. These houses belong to Ontario Hydro, or Hydro as it is now called, Hydro One as it is now called, in the small community of Hunta are no longer. Another childhood home now gone. Finally, in 1965, we relocated from Hunta to reside in another Northern Ontario Hydro community called Abitibi Canyon, located 100 miles south of Moosonee. If you wanted to drive the long dirt road from Smooth Rock Falls, then it was 45 miles north and 3 miles west of the canyon, a small building on the railway tracks called Fraserdale. Then, if you wanted to head north to Moosonee from the canyon, you had to take the Polar Bear Express train from the Fraserdale train station. Although a lot of travelers would embark on the Polar Bear Express train ride from Cochrane. My grade 8 graduation trip in 1970 was to Moosonee. To add more excitement to our graduation trip, we took a ferry boat ride to Moose Factory Island. On the trip, I also enjoyed touching the fur pelts at the local Hudson Bay outlet. It was a fun-filled, interesting trip where I couldn't get over how it seemed that every Indigenous family, every Cree family, had a husky dog or two or three in front of their homes. We resided in Abitibi Canyon from 1965 to 1973. Previously, my dad worked for 1 year at the same location at the same generating station from 1953 to 1954 before my parents married. When we were living in the canyon, when we first resided in the canyon in 1965, we resided in a pink bungalow, which is the fifth house in the bottom inner circle of the new colony, for a few years, then moved to a two-story, four-bedroom house on the outer circle of the colony, second colony. My mother has scrapbooks filled with newspaper clippings and articles and notes about our time in the canyon. During his tenure at Abitibi Canyon, my dad's job classification was a first operator, and he worked at the power dam. Three shifts, 8 hours in length, days, afternoon, or midnight shifts. My mother would have a heck of a time to keep six kids quiet during the day so that my father could sleep to be rested enough to work his midnight shifts. I have many fond memories of Abitibi Canyon, which during this time period housed 85 families. The fast, dark, brown moving current of the Abitibi River is where we swam in the summer, along with boating, water skiing, and go fishing. There was a small hospital and a bunkhouse for the single men and a small general store where my mother would purchase very expensive milk because we lived so far north and grocery items for her family. Ontario Hydro built a large recreation center for this remote location and hydro families so that now year-round we could also swim in the indoor pool, bowl in the four-lane bowling alley, curl on the three-sheet curling rink, play hockey, basketball, or do some figure skating in the ice arena. We could also browse the books in the library, or use the gymnasium for various sports and monthly dances, or the curling lounge for meetings and teen activities. There was a cafeteria which had a full kitchen and big area with tables and chairs. Briefly, I was president of the teen club and would book some rock bands to come into the canyon for our teen dances. The bands came from Smooth Rock Falls, Cochrane, or Kapuskasing. Also, for one summer, my student job was to work as a recreation youth broker to organize activities for the younger children. On top of Blueberry Hill, behind the recreation center, were a few grave sites of some men that perished during the construction of the power dam. Also, the dam was rumored to have a ghost, which some of the workers would hear or feel during the late night shifts. The torrents of water from the mighty Abitibi Canyon River were breathtaking. If you boat up and down river, you could be sure to find remnants of fur trappers' campsites. We had winter carnivals in front of the recreation center with the usual winter activities along with log sawing contests. Or one time, there was a contest as to which man during a specific time period grew the longest beard. Even my dad tried out for the contest. One of my brothers was also carnival king for 1 year. In the summer, from the adults to the young kids, on a well-used dusty baseball diamond between the old circled colony and the newer circled colony of Hydro Homes is where we played baseball. That is where a lot of us would spend a fun-filled afternoon swinging away and running bases. Located in the older section of the canyon, facing the recreation center, is where our school, Fraserdale Public School, was, which taught classes from kindergarten to grade 8. In the winter, we all wore from head to toe one-piece snowsuits to walk to school in sub-zero temperatures of winter with what seemed like forever long freezing cold weather. Generally, everyone walked in the winter, as a lot of times the cars wouldn't start anyway. For my grade 8 graduation, it was just a normal day at school in Abitibi Canyon. The whole class, along with our teacher, reviewed all of our report cards, and that was it. No dance, no party. So to celebrate on our own, a few of us girls decided to go to an abandoned hunt camp just north of the canyon through dense bush. We made plans to swim in a tiny glacier-made lake called Pickle Lake and to enjoy a sleepover party at the old camp. The lake was only about 10 feet deep, and it was crystal clear where you could see right to the bottom with no fish at all. The water temperature was cold for swimming, but exhilarating. At night, though, for our sleepover in the old camp, we were so scared as we thought we could hear rustling in the woods and assumed it was hungry and dangerous bears. So we banged pots and pans together most of the night to hopefully scare away any of the wildlife. We were so exhausted the next day when we hiked back home, but for a bunch of 13 and 14-year-old girls, we felt it was a celebration of another milestone in our lives. And as tired and scared as we were, it was still a good time. Part 3 of I Have No Hometown. For the secondary school students, we traveled by bus on the dirt road 1 hour to Smooth Rock Falls, and then back home at the end of the day, another hour. I hated that bus ride. On the way to school, in the middle of nowhere, on the side of the road, there were 2 Cree Native students that would wait for the bus so that they too could attend school in Smooth Rock Falls. They were so shy to talk to, but I would try anyways. One of my brothers wanted to attend the technical secondary school in Kapuskasing, and like so many other Canyon guys, would board at people's homes in Cap for the week and then come home on the weekends. Mostly everyone had snow machines for their own use in the winter to go ice fishing, and for the summer, many people own their own boats as the fishing was bountiful in the mighty Abitibi River. On one fishing trip, my father caught a 63-pound sturgeon fish. He donated his big catch to the local native community at Fraserdale. They were very grateful. The fishing was not so good in some of the smaller lakes, which were completely devoid of fish. Apparently, these small lakes were created from glaciers. But there were occasions when my father and a few of his friends would load up pack sacks on their backs filled with bags of water, which had all kinds of minnows. The men would cut trails through the bush and release the fish fingerlings of assorted variety, mainly lake trout and rainbow trout, into the many small lakes. The releasing of fingerlings were part of belonging to the local fish and game conservation club. Sometimes the fish were also dropped from small pontoon airplanes from the Ministry of Natural Resources. Actually, in the 1970s, the currently named Ministry of Natural Resources was called Department of Lands and Forests. When this provincial department was renamed Ministry of Natural Resources, there was an ongoing joke between some of the Abitibi Club members that the MNR should have been called MCB, Ministry of Creeks and Bogs, especially for the north. My dad and some of his friends also taught the hunter safety course for the local teenagers. I took only one lesson on how to fire a rifle, and that was it. I didn't continue the lessons. But mostly every other teenager in our colony had taken this course. The fossils we found were amazing. I found the most perfect fossil of a full-size insect, but my grade 8 teacher and principal at the time asked if I could keep the fossil. I regret giving him the fossil because at that time, not knowing the importance of that kind of a find, I felt this principal took advantage of this remarkable specimen. I really hope that he at least donated the fossil to a museum. Bears were common, and I remember seeing at dusk the outline of my dad on the outside hills of the colony in a silhouette, standing on guard with his rifle and his pipe with his favorite tobacco, waiting and on watch for the bears at night. There were so many at one time that they had to be killed so the kids of the colony wouldn't be in danger walking the streets, even during the day. The flies were terrible. Another nightly routine I remember was the fogger machine, which was pulled by a small tractor almost every summer morning and night to expel pesticides, mostly to try and kill the mosquitoes and black flies. It was great fun for all of us, as we would run after the fogger, then try to run through the cloud, which I am sure was filled with a toxic mixture. Men would also treat the lakes and ponds to destroy the larvae of the flies. Whenever we would walk down the dirt rounds in the colony, the joke commonly expressed was that everyone had their own personal cloud of black flies flying above their head. We had great fun playing in the bush, making forts and tree stands, and running through the amazing creeks. My dad built us another set of swings in our backyard, and again our black and white television received the CBC television channel, where my brothers were hooked on watching the cowboy show called Bonanza, which was a weekly television series. With the 85 families at that time and approximately 45 teenagers in the colony, when I was a teenager, to pass the time, we had a lot of house parties in our basements. On our record players, we played the LPs, the Beatles, and all the heavies, the Rolling Stones, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and so on. Some of us were dressed as hippies who made us think we were pretty cool. I used to babysit quite a lot and use that money to pay for my own piano lessons. Overall, we were able to do a lot of things in this small community. Once a month, a movie would be paid for by Hydro and brought in where we would all get to see it in the gym. With the stage at the gym, we had recitals there and other functions. A weekly church service was held at the old recreation center whenever a priest was available, and I was a reader at some of the masses. Once during the winter, I remember my yellow and black skidoo breaking down and stalling at around 5 p.m. when I was snowmobiling by myself. I was about the age of 14 years old. This was at dusk in the bush, way behind my parents' house. I was traveling through a clearing under the power line, enjoying the winter ride, and then my snow machine stalled, and the more I tried to get it going again, it became entrenched in the deep snow. I was stuck. I was stuck in the snow. It was starting to get dark, and I could hear some wolves howling, and I was scared. I remember trying to lift up my snow machine out of the snow. Finally exhausted, I just plunked down on the black leather seat and thought of what to do. So I just started to pray that someone would come and rescue me, as no one knew where I had gone, and it was cold, getting dark, and I was worried about the wolves. Then all of a sudden, I could hear the rumble of a skidoo. It was my neighbor's son coming up through the clearing on the powdery snow. He said, "I just had a feeling to go for a snow machine ride, even though it was supper time." He still felt he should go anyways. I was so thankful and relieved, because there was no way I would have made it back home in the dark and freezing cold. Thank God. My friend was able to lift up my snow machine, and then I followed him back to safety. We left the canyon, Abitibi Canyon, when I was 16 years old in June of 1973 and relocated to Hanmer, Ontario. We did this so my dad could work at the Hanmer Transformer Station, which is a hub for transmission from Abitibi to Pickering. My dad is deceased now, but he was an avid golfer and curler. My mother is keeping busy with family events and golfs weekly and enjoys many church activities. Footnote here, since it is 2024, my mother recently passed away in September of 2023. So both my parents are no longer here. To carry on, my parents did celebrate 50 wonderful years of marriage with many good memories, but it was difficult to reside in these many small bush communities. Abitibi Canyon, as I knew it, is now completely gone. All of the houses were sold and transported out to Smooth Rock Falls and to other small towns nearby. The general store, post office, the baseball diamond, the wonderful recreation center, and both of my childhood and teenage homes in the canyon are no longer. All gone. Again, another Northern Ontario hometown disappeared, and only the memories of the sounds and chatter and laughter echo in my mind, and only the ghosts of past years remain. It is July 2009, and I reside in Sudbury, Ontario. I've been thinking, with the latest massive layoffs by the many local industries, and presently with the current strike by the unionized miners against the foreign owners of the local mines, who knows, is Sudbury next? The end. And to go back again, this was published in 2009, so here we are in 2024. And Sudbury, Greater Sudbury, is still in existence, so that's good for me and for all the residents, of course, that live in this area. And now to carry on with this podcast, I have two publications. One was written by Jean R. Ellis, and she entitled it Memories. And the reason why I have that, the Ellises, Roy and Jean, were very close friends with my parents. They went on trips with them out west and down east in Canada, and they were dear, dear friends with my parents. And there's a little excerpt here where Jean talks about when they moved to Abitibi Canyon. It was in February 1965, and they had spent the night with my parents, Sue and Richard Beaudry in Hunta. This was before my parents moved to Abitibi Canyon. And they talked about staying at my parents' house in Hunta, which was really nice to read about. Apparently, they had a dog named Boots, and that my brothers were so overjoyed to have this little dog to play with that it kept them up all night. And that my dad was annoyed with my brothers for not sleeping. But it's little anecdotes like that that Jean writes about and living in the canyon. Jean also talked about one time heading towards Smooth Rock Falls. It was about a 45-minute drive from Abitibi Canyon south to Smooth Rock Falls. And there was a time that their car had broken down, and she went ahead walking up to Smooth Rock Falls to buy an item at the hardware store. And it wasn't exactly what her husband wanted, but he ended up walking to the hardware store, and she was stranded on the dirt road with her mother, broken down car, dust and black flies. And another small anecdote she wrote about was that one evening at my parents' home, they wanted a little bit of excitement. And so they decided to pull a prank on Mr. Clark, Bill Clark. And so they went outside and they headed outdoor, and I guess somehow Bill Clark knew about it, that there was this rowdy gang of women cruising the colony. And I think my dad was the one who told him. And so Bill Clark ran out the door with his uniform, and they all got busted. So the greatest thing about living in a small hydro community was the closeness with the adults amongst each other, the parties they had, and the get-togethers and the dances. And I remember when we moved to Hanmer after living in the canyon for that many years, how my mother was so lonely. And here we are in a bigger town, yet she was so lonely. And I remember saying to her, well, why not join the Catholic Women's League at the church that she was now attending in Hanmer? So she did. But that's the thing. When you leave a small community, you become so close with your friends that when you live now or move to a bigger community, a town or city, it can be so lonely. And my mother experienced that when she left the canyon and all her dear friends, and my father too. So another lady wrote a book, Life in the Colonies. It was written by Isabel Wilson. And she wrote a book entitled Life in the Colonies, again, another hydro family. And she titled her book, The Dam Towns, meaning the hydro dams. So it's her memories of life in the dam towns of the Hydroelectric Power Commission and Ontario Hydro. And now we call it Hydro One. And she mentioned me on in her book with stories on pages 78 to 81 and 84 to 86. So I'll go to those right now. So to quote a few words from Isabel Wilson's book, Life in the Colonies, her introduction is basically talking about living in the colonies, the hydro colonies. And she wrote, harnessing the power of Ontario's mighty rivers meant dams and generating stations had to be built, usually in isolated areas. Construction workers and later employees had to be housed in colonies, some just houses, some like little villages came into being. This created a whole new group of pioneers who may not have had as hard a life as their original settlers, but had to adjust to a different lifestyle, sometimes far away from their families. Made redundant by new technology and automation, the colony life no longer exists. We are left with only the memories, which this book, Life in the Colonies, The Dam Towns by Isabel Wilson, is trying to capture and pass on, providing reminiscences for some and enlightenment for others. Isabel wrote my name in her book, and she wrote a little bit of information that I sent to her. She wrote this, I received some information from Joanne Beaudry-Larocque, whose father was an operator with Ontario Hydro, which took them to many of the northern colonies and communities. She has written articles on life in the north in communities that no longer exist. She lived in the Abitibi Canyon Colony from 1965 to 1973, and like most colony-raised children, especially in the more northern areas, has fond memories of the closeness of families, the outdoor activities, and the opportunities to see areas of our country in their most natural form. Isabel Wilson also wrote about, especially living in Abitibi Canyon, along with raising a family, there was plenty to do, but some couldn't shed the idea of being cut off from the outer world. Expectant mothers were sent out ahead of time by train to Cochrane or make other arrangements. My mother had two of my younger brothers. She gave birth to them in Cochrane, but we were living in Abitibi Canyon at the same time. So that was maybe a good hour and a half away from Abitibi Canyon. I'm not sure of the mileage offhand, but so it was, you weren't able to just deliver in the local hospital where we lived. You had to go to another town or sometimes to your parents' hometown and deliver your babies there. So the school that I attended in Abitibi Canyon was called Fraserdale Public School, and it went from kindergarten to grade 8. And then in 1966, a road to Smooth Rock Falls was open. And then students were bused to Smooth Rock Falls for grade 9 to 12. But then a lot of the men or the boys in the canyon, I should say the high school age boys, some went to Smooth Rock Falls and some went to Timmins or Kapuskasing for more technical education. So, but by 1982, there were about 300 people living in the colony, Abitibi Canyon, but there was still a big yearly turnover in staff because not everyone could adjust to the isolation, the cold winters, the flies. And eventually in 1980, Hydro decided to close down the community, which took about 2 years to complete. So again, as I mentioned before, all of the homes were removed. And to this day, though, the dam is still in Abitibi Canyon, but it's known as Base Abitibi Canyon, where another industry has just taken off, which is the snowmobile industry. So they actually have a website that you can look into if you're a snowmobiler or a sledder. And they make trips from Cochrane, Smooth Rock Falls, Kapuskasing, tourists from Michigan and other northern states will make their way all the way up to Abitibi Canyon. And they have a base camp there. I think that's what's called Base Camp Abitibi Canyon. So still people are going up that way. And the Isabel's book is really interesting. And of course, Jean Ellis's memoir book is very interesting. And then over last summer, we had some company, which was the Rollinsons. And Mr. and Mrs. Rollinson were our first neighbors in Abitibi Canyon. And she's the lady that I would babysit her two younger daughters. But I would barter with her that she could teach me piano lessons. So that's how I learned how to play piano. My parents didn't own a piano, but I really wanted to play. And so I would babysit Mr. and Mrs. Rollinson's two daughters. And then in exchange, she would teach me how to play, which I just loved. And then anytime I went to babysit, I would practice my songs. And also at the school, at Fraserdale Public School, there was a piano there, and I would practice my songs there too. But I asked Mr. Rollinson, how the heck did he get a piano up to Abitibi Canyon? And he said, well, first of all, he ordered one from the Eaton's catalog, and then the piano was shipped from Eaton's department store in Toronto on the train, and it was shipped up by train to all the way up to Cochrane and north of Cochrane on the Polar Bear Express to Abitibi Canyon. And so Mr. Rollinson had a truck, and they picked up the piano and they brought it through the door of their house in Abitibi Canyon. And that's about 900 miles north from Toronto. And that's how that piano ended up at their house. And that's the piano that I learned how to play on with the graciousness of the Rollinsons. And they're just such sweet people. So anyway, it's kind of nice to reflect back. And it's been nice for me anyways to talk about this. I'm not sad about it, but, you know, I realize technology has its place. And we lived in isolated communities, which was very unique for us. And they no longer exist. But I have memories. And even as a young girl, I had a little Kodak Instamatic camera, and I still took pictures. I still take a lot of pictures. Now I use my cell phone mostly, but I ended up buying a professional camera, and I sold some of my photos over the years. But, you know, I always took pictures wherever I went, and I was always writing. So I wrote about these kinds of memories, and thankfully I was able to write all this down before someday I get too old and I won't be able to remember some of these wonderful memories I have. And the greatest thing about living in the Hydro colonies is the friends that I still have to this day. I'm 3 years away from being, or 2 years away from being 70, turning 70, and I still have a lot of my friends from Abitibi Canyon, and even before that area, even near Matabichuan, near Haileybury. There's someone that's on my Facebook who's still a friend of mine. So the closeness and community that, you know, you get from living in a small, tight-knit community is something that never leaves you. And you can find information about Abitibi Canyon on Facebook. They have a pretty good little site. And there's a small museum in Smooth Rock Falls where the curator at that museum has a lot of information about Abitibi Canyon and possibly Hunta as well, I'm sure, near Cochrane. So, and Cochrane is great if you ever head up that way. There's an amazing polar bear enclosure there where you can see polar bears swimming in the water and walking on land, and it's kind of a touristy attraction. So that's kind of interesting as well. And now to just give a mention to this writer, Denis Oleskovich. I believe he is from Smooth Rock Falls, and he wrote a short story entitled Frasedel. So Denis, thank you so much for sharing your story with me. It's a brief little story, but it talks about Abitibi Canyon. So here it goes. Short story, Frasedel, by Denis Oleskovich. The Screaming Lady of the Dead Man Dam. Frasedel, 75 kilometers north of Smooth Rock Falls along Highway 634 and 54 kilometers south of the Otto Rapids Hydroelectric Generating Station, is not a ghost town. Not literally, anyway. Randy McDonald says there are maybe 7 families living there, but they're not easy to find. This was dated in 2015. Because what is left of Frasedel has no roads, no signs, indeed no sign of life, not even from the polished iron rails of the Ontario Northland Railway, not even from the train station, where a light, but no life, shines through the mist of the early evening. Randy McDonald, in fact, is the only sign of life, and he's not even in Frasedel. He's 4 kilometers away on the other side of the tracks in a trailer atop the dam at the Abitibi Canyon Generating Station of Ontario Power Generation. Ghost town? Randy smiles indulgently. Once there was a colony here, he says. There were more than 70 houses, a school, a church, a grocery store, and a post office that doubled as a kind of a bank. We had satellite television and, well, a fair amount of alcohol. The colony at Abitibi Canyon was made up of Ontario Hydro employees and support workers, for the most part, he said. On the other side of the figurative tracks was Frasedel, which had about 20 houses or so, a train station, because that's where Ontario Northland's Polar Bear Express and Little Bear pass through on their ways to and from Moosonee. Frasedel and Abitibi Canyon were as different as Toronto's Rosedale and New York's ghettos. Today, though, Abitibi Canyon's more of a ghost town than is Frasedel, because there are still some people in Frasedel, but there's nobody in Abitibi Canyon except the 35 or so workers who drive in from Timmins or Kapuskasing or Smooth Rock Falls for a week's work before going home again. It wasn't too hard to prepare for the mysteries of Abitibi Canyon and Frasedel. Leaving Smooth Rock Falls and driving north in a sedan with a Cleveland V8 engine approximately the size of a Queen Mary turbine throbbing under the hood, with the nearest gas station and its $1.40 a liter fuel dropping farther and farther behind, with no spare tire and only a sleeping dog for company, with the skies blackening and lightning flashing, thoughts of discontent are bound to creep into the fragile mind of someone who fears spiders and heights as much as he fears ghost stories and thunderstorms. About halfway up the 74-kilometer road, a partridge stands curiously in the glare of the headlights, unmoving. Some say partridges are stupid. They have been on Earth for many millennia before man, and they will be on earth many millennia after man. Partridges do not drive on lonely roads with no spare tire, low on gas, with no cellular telephone service if anything should go wrong, just to get a story. There is not too much convincing needed for the boy and his dog to get out of Fraserdale. Darkness is coming. Abandoned cars suddenly seem to be moving. There is a satellite dish on a boarded up on house. And why is there a light on at the train station when it's obvious nobody set a foot around that place for, well, a ghost age? Dear God, please let the car start over the bumpy gravel road for maybe half a kilometer to the stop sign and down 4 kilometers of paved highway to the dam and the lights and 7 trucks and not a sign of light, life except a man in an orange vest seen through the window of a trailer atop the dam itself. On one side of the dam is the backed up Abitibi River. Randy McDonald says it's more than 220 feet deep, and he won't fish there because there's mercury in the water, much of it naturally occurring in the rocks around the site. On the other side of the dam is a drop that would terrify an experienced skydiver. Randy is genial, pleasant, as are many isolated workers who seldom get company save the company of the work crew on site. He's glad for a new face, glad to chat about the history of the huge power project, glad to remind a visitor that he's sitting in a chair in a trailer atop a dam that was built in the 1930s and where maybe 4 bodies are interred in the concrete of the massive structure where 5 huge turbines spinning at 100 RPM provide electric power to Ontario's teeming masses, and where maybe 200 people who worked on the construction of the dam are still officially reported missing. Ghost towns? He laughs. You've come to the right place. Randy was instrumental in restoring a monument atop the dam, a monument to the men who gave their lives in the construction of a power-generating station that has lit the lamps of Ontario for 70 years since. The monument is dedicated, interestingly, to the Sons of Martha, although he has no idea why. There are no names on the monument because nobody knows for sure who died, just that 4 or maybe more actually did, and they lie at rest in the concrete mass of the dam, lulled forever in their sleep by the whirring drone of the turbines. The ghost stories of the colony are legion, he says. But the ones that carry the most weight is the tale of the Screaming Lady. Atop a hill on the west side of the Abitibi, overlooking the colony, was a house, an empty house, boarded up, where night after night the sounds of a screaming lady could be heard. Townsfolk were alternately terrified and intrigued until one group decided to camp out near the house for an entire night to determine once and for all whether the screaming lady was real. They stayed, they partied a bit, and heard nary a sound, so they simply went home. They went back in the morning. The abandoned house, boarded up, alone on the hill, had burned to the ground. It appears no cause was ever determined, although, admittedly, not too many people dared go close enough to check too closely. Another house, says McDonald, who lived on site from 1982, had pieces of furniture that mysteriously moved from place to place on their own, thereby terrifying anyone who lived in the house, causing them to move. Darkness has enveloped the dam site like a glove, like a blanket of warmth and comfort for Randy, like a blanket of fear for the visitor. Randy says, in response to a worried query about wildlife on the road that ends 55 kilometers north, closer to Moosonee than to Highway 11, You don't have to worry about hitting a moose if you're careful. What you have to worry about is seeing something on the road that you can drive right through. And a smile and a wave, and I've got to leave you now, and he's gone. All the way back to civilization, there are monsters under the car seat. That was interesting. Thank you, Dennis, so much for sending that to me, Dennis Liskovich, and it was written in January 6, 2015. And again, in thinking of my fossil that I found, that the principal of the Fraserdale Public School asked me for, and I reluctantly gave it to him, and apparently his grandson has it, because I was talking to the principal's daughter. I really would like it back, but I'm not going to be asking the grandson for this fossil back. But I did write a story, and it's a very, very short story called The Fossilized Honeycomb. But the fossil that I found was an insect. It was a perfect insect inside. You could see it fossilized in the rock. So I can still think of that. And to this day, I still collect fossils. I have rocks all around I have a garden pond, and all my fossils are there, and I have some downstairs in front of our fireplace. So I've always, like my dad, I've always been interested in rocks and seeing rocks and knowing the names of them, and then, of course, fossils. So I wrote a brief story, and I'll read that to you, and this kind of plays into living in the canyon and finding fossils. So it was written when I was with the Sudbury Writers Guild. I was with two writers clubs, the Barrie Writers Club and the Sudbury Writers Guild. And this was written in November 2008. And I'll read you the synopsis first, and then I'll read you the ending of the story. So the synopsis is The Fossilized Honeycomb by Joanne K. Beaudry-Laroque, dated November 17, 2008. The bees, hard at work, as they always were, flirted in and out of the small honeycomb as honey oozed out from the round enclosure onto the fertile ground. A small female child with long, black, messy hair noticed the sticky golden flow dripping slowly from the oval gray-colored thing hanging from the side of the tree. Curious, she tried to gingerly touch it, but was still frightened at the same time. She changed her mind and subsequently yanked her hand away from the bright droplets. Gathering up more courage, she took a closer look at the buzzing bees and their interesting structure they were swirling around. Again, the petite little girl, clothed with furry musk ox garments, wanted to touch the honeycomb, although was afraid and just wouldn't do it. So she walked away a few steps with her bare feet, avoiding the sharp rocks and the tall jungle-type plants on the prehistoric ground, chastising herself for not being brave like her warrior brothers. She decided she wanted to try just one more time. She ran back to the noisy beehive and aggressively reached out to the golden droplets and touched the sticky stuff. Impulsively, she tasted it. "Yum," she said with savory delight. It was good tasting and sweet. Greedily, she decided to reach upwards amidst the buzzing bees to grab a hold of the honeycomb. She wanted to bring her prize to her parents, who dwelled close by inside their granite rocky cave. No fear now, as she took hold of the bee's honeycomb and pulled. In the same instant, there was an incredible flash of light and loud, deafening, thunderous noise. A million years later, a young Cree girl was playing on the shore of a nearby rippling creek with no more than a few centimeters of water flowing over assorted colorful rounded stones. She noticed the most interesting rock. Picking it up, she took a good look. Frightened by this strange rock with hundreds of individual small holes, she dropped it to the sandy ground. And now I will continue with the ending. The first part was a bit of a synopsis of the story, a bit of a prompt for me to write the ending. So here's the ending of the fossilized honeycomb. Coral, Joe, please take ice and cobalt with you to visit old man Professor B, and he'll tell you about your new discovery. You know, the fossil thing that you found when you were by the creek, where you shouldn't have been in the first place? Exasperated by your young daughter's incessant questions about her new find, Inez put on her warm parka as she was about to head outdoors into the frosty Northern Ontario cold. Sighing heavily, her young daughter, with the dark, shiny black hair and brown eyes, cupped the fossil in her hands and inserted it into her caribou skin bag. Grabbing her beige moccasins, which were decorated with red and white plastic tiny beads, yanked them over her bare feet, and, just to annoy her mother even more, finished her supper as fast as she could, noisily chewing the rest of the chunks of bear meat that was left on her dinner plate. "Don't hide your goodness, little one," smirked her mother as she waited for her daughter to put on her coat. "Off you go," she said as she nudged her daughter gently out the door. It was early April, and there were remnants of darkened snow on the ground in Moosonee. Although that didn't bother Coral Joe, as she yelled for her two husky dogs to follow her, the precocious little girl walked down the rough road, carved out of gravel and dirt, to see the professor and his wife. Yelping and barking, her two frisky dogs, Cobalt and Ice, ran ahead as they sensed where they were going. Professor R.M. Beaudray, who held an earth sciences degree but had worked as an electrical engineer in his younger years, was now retired and enjoyed a quieter life with his wife, Sue. Professor B., as he was commonly known in the James Bay area, was also referred to, respectively, as a walking book of knowledge. Prospecting the rocky, sparse area of the north, which still held for him the possibility of the next great find, would embark on many small journeys, which kept him occupied most days. As he went to answer the door, Professor B. had his usual cup of coffee in his right hand, plus in his mouth his chewed-up pipe with his favorite tobacco. When he saw it was Coral Joe standing at the door, he quickly snuffed out his pipe and tucked it amidst a few other pens and pencils inside the front pocket of his red and black flannel shirt. "Well, hi there, Squirt. Come on in," as he warmly greeted the little girl. He opened the wooden door wider for her and also for her frisky dogs to come into the small bungalow. "Hi, Bee," sighed Coral Joe. With downcast eyes, she followed her dogs as they snuggled down onto the coiled braided rug, which was close to the flickering fireplace in the living room. "What's wrong?" asked the professor to the dejected little girl. She sighed again. Still no answer came from her. "Hey, Sue, can you please bring us some peanut butter cookies for our little visitor?" asked the professor to his busy wife and mother of their six Métis kids. Their six kids, now ranging from ages 8 to 18, were helping out at the local Hudson Bay store located on nearby Moose Factory Island. It was a way to earn pocket money on a Saturday. Therefore, without their kids in the house, the professor's wife had some quiet spare time to bake dessert for her family. "Well, I found another rock or fossil or something, and I'm not sure if it's worth anything," perked up Coral Joe. She quickly pulled out her precious find and handed it over to the professor. "Let's see what it is," asked the professor gingerly, as the professor gingerly held the fossil. With his sparkly light brown eyes, he exclaimed, "Wow, you found a honeycomb, a fossilized honeycomb. Good job." "Is it a real good find?" Coral Joe asked. "Why, of course it is, especially since bees are almost all extinct now. It's a real good discovery," he exclaimed. "We will have to add it to the workshop, if that is okay with you," the professor asked. His wife, who overheard her husband, said, "Richard, your workshop is a cluttered mess. Why, with all your rocks, your fossils, your finds, and never mind the odd tools between the pieces of driftwood, where would you put this new discovery?" Coral Joe laughed out loud, then giggled. She exclaimed, "Bee, I just knew you would like this new rock." So after shuffling the pieces of assorted rocks, consisting of quartz, mica, and nickel, and a few other objects aside, the pair put their new find on one of the dusty glass shells. "See, what did I tell you? If you work very hard at something, you are bound to succeed. You wanted to be a discoverer like me, and now you are," Professor Beaudry told Coral Joe. Happily, the little girl and her dogs went back to her home, satisfied of her day. Later on in the evening, the professor's wife asked her husband, "Why did you bother to keep the fossil?" Sadly, he replied, "Remember what I told you? Once all the bugs and insects die, as they have been for years now, our planet as we know it will not survive, which is why that fossilized honeycomb represents what was." And that's the end of that brief story in November 2008. And so a little footnote for that I wrote after I wrote that submission in 2008. I wrote this: if you remove all of the bugs and insects from our planet, especially bees, the earth that we know it will die. But if you remove all of us humans, the planet will still survive and more than likely thrive. We are the ones destroying our planet. So as a reminder, please don't destroy the bees. Leave the honeycombs alone. Trees are important too, as a tree is the filter for our air, to keep our air clean and clear of harmful gases. So plant flowers that attract bees. That's kind of the moral of that story is bees, and whether, you know, we think about black flies, mosquitoes, whatever, bees especially are so important as they pollinate our trees, our fruit trees, and plants that we grow in our vegetable gardens and so on and so forth. And that's why we try not to cut our lawn in the early spring, and we leave the dandelions that are there and that we feel is food for the bees out there. And finally, to wrap this up, I wrote a poem, and this is the very end of this episode. And I have so many other published stories and poems that I'd like to read, but to wrap this one up, talking about I Have No Hometown, I really miss living in Abitibi Canyon, and a good friend of mine, Carmen Martorella, just provided for me a beautiful painting she did of the Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis, because in the winter time, I remember looking up and you could see the snowflakes falling gently down from the sky, and the black sky, and there was no light noise, as they call it, or no pollution of lots of lights. So we could really see the stars, the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper. But one of the things that I really remember living up in the canyon, we call it the canyon, was the seeing the Northern Lights. The colors were so beautiful. And Carmen just gifted me a beautiful painting to thank me for interviewing her and her husband, Daniel Vincent, for my podcast. And I have that displayed in my house now. And I look at that painting of the Northern Lights, and it just takes me back to when I was a young girl and a teenager living in the canyon. So to end this episode, I'm going to read to you a poem that I wrote. I've written many poems, and many of them have been published. Some I have not shared because they're too emotional to read over some different times in my life, but this poem that I wrote really kind of encapsulates how I felt by living in Northern Ontario. I still technically live in Northern Ontario, living in Greater Sudbury, but really Northern Ontario is up in Abitibi Canyon near James Bay and Hudson Bay and Thunder Bay and all of those areas. So Barrie is considered Central Ontario, but Greater Sudbury, they still say it's Northern Ontario, so whatever. Anyway, this poem is called Stillness, a Northern Ontario poem. And in the background, you're going to hear sometimes snow machines. It's February, or March now. We just are starting the month of March, so you're hearing sometimes snow machines and you hear ATVs going by. So we live in the rural area. Anyway, so this poem is entitled Stillness, a Northern Ontario Poem by Joanne K. Beaudry-Larocque, May 23rd, 2011. Campfire crackles, marshmallows glow, gentle waves rippling into pebbly shore, to and fro. Boat for a spin on wide open water, canoe gently, quietly making its way through glacial lake, careful not to wake a sleeping otter. Perch slayer, bass catcher, barbut to go, many cast out their fishing lines. Pickerel and northern pike abound as we row. Bear, moose, deer, wolves howl in the night. Beavers, raccoons, bobcats look up as loons call out in twilight. Black flies encircle us like best friends. Mosquitoes land on exposed skin. We may be deceived until they descend. Deer flies have a nasty bite, and horse flies will carry you away. You try to escape the bush and muskeg. Bug spray only works temporarily. Respray. Northern lights, river, dance up in dark sky. Pine, balsam, and spruce trees, Northern Ontario woods reach up high. Inukshuks dotted along a lonely highway, polar bear express to Moosonee, dusty roads lead the way. Native artifacts of peaceful travel, it almost seems like the world goes silent, except the noise of tires crunching gravel. Deep snow and short snowshoes are to be had. Snowflakes fall from blue frozen sky. It's the great white north. It's not so bad. Snowbanks can almost reach street lights. With so much snow and nowhere to go, snow piles are shoveled up into enormous heights. Clean, fresh atmosphere, stillness throughout, remnants of fur trappers' cabins, fossils in creeks, this is what you find day in and day out. The sound of crickets sing me softly to sleep. I dream of how much I love living here, for this land is in my heart to keep. And that, folks, is the end. I really hope that you enjoy this episode. It's sometimes difficult to reflect on places that you miss and people that you miss. Thank you for being my audience. I'm truly grateful for all of you, for being my listening audience, for sharing my podcast, for those who have sponsored by buying me a cup of coffee. I'm in that program. I'm also on Patreon. If you want to reach out to me, my email address is small letters, J for Joanne, M for Mike, B for Brent, J for Jessica, C for Chanel, 8@hotmail.com. I'm on Facebook, Joanne LaRocque or Joanne Beaudry-Larocque. You can find me there. And if you wish to share your story, your reflection or your memories of days gone by or of any story that you'd like to share with me for me to interview you, please reach out. So thank you to all of you. I really am grateful for you all. And please take care. God bless. Bye.